It is a blessing to be together this morning. It's a blessing to have so many brothers and sisters visiting with us this morning. Welcome all of you. We are studying from the book of Joshua together in our Bible class. And we are just ready to get into Joshua chapter 9. We're in Joshua chapter 9. And just to give us some sense of where we have been, over the last couple of chapters, we've been dealing with the battle at Ai, or the battles at Ai, and Achan's sin. Where the Lord, as Joshua is leading Israel through the land of Canaan to conquer it, to give Israel their promised inheritance, the Lord has told Israel at points to utterly devote the Canaanites to destruction. That was the case with Jericho in chapter 6, and Israel was to take nothing from Jericho. Achan saw some stuff in the spoil that looked good and decided to take it. And because he took the devoted things, his guilt came upon all Israel, so that Israel suffered defeat at the hands of their enemies in Joshua chapter 7. So that's dealt with in chapter 7. They go back and fight again at Ai in chapter 8, and the Lord gives them the victory because they have dealt with Achan's sin. And so now we are ready to move on to what we find in Joshua chapter 9. Let's go ahead and read the first two verses together. As soon as all the kings who were beyond the Jordan in the hill country and in the lowland all along the coast of the great sea toward Lebanon, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites heard of this, they gathered together as one to fight against Joshua and Israel. All right, so this opening gives us, it's not just an introduction to the story of chapter 9 that we're about to read, but it's the introduction to a whole campaign that is about to take place. It's going to reach over chapter 9 and chapter 10. All right, so this is setting the stage. We're told of a coalition of kings who are planning to wage war against Israel. All right, so this is a major threat to Israel. You've got all of these kings gathering together, teaming up to fight Israel. Now, the story is eventually going to tell us how this threat is dealt with. But that's not where it's going to go first. The story is going to it's going to suddenly shift in direction in the next verse. But before we do that, I want us to consider the behavior of these nations in these first two verses. And we'll just, for the sake of ease, instead of saying Hittites, Amorites, Canaanites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites every single time we refer to them, we'll just say Canaanites. So how have the Canaanites been reacting to Israel's presence up to this point? Solomon?
They're like trembling.
Yes, they have been in fear. All right, we've read that a couple of times. We first heard that from Rahab back in Joshua chapter 2. Remember, the spies go to Jericho, and they're talking with Rahab, who's hiding them. And Rahab tells them that the report of Israel has gone out into the land. All of the Canaanites have heard about what God has done for Israel, how they defeated Egypt, how they defeated the kings of the Amorites on the other side of the river, and how everybody's heart is melting with fear. We read exactly the same thing in chapter 5, verse 1. After Israel crosses the river Jordan, as soon as all the kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan to the west, all the kings of the Canaanites who were by the sea heard that the Lord had dried up the waters of the Jordan for the people of Israel until they had crossed over. Their hearts melted. There was no longer any spirit in them because of the people of Israel. Well, notice, by the way, a similar pattern here. Just like we read at the beginning of chapter 9, the Canaanites hear something and they react. In chapter 5, they're hearing about the river crossing and they react by trembling in fear. Here in Joshua chapter 9, they hear, and something entirely different happens. They were so fearful beforehand that they wouldn't even attack Israel when Israel was at its most vulnerable. Remember, after they cross the River Jordan, they undergo a mass circumcision. And that is when they are at their most vulnerable. They've got the river at their backs. They've got nowhere to retreat to. They are physically weak, in pain. It's a surgery that requires, in antiquity, it requires several days to recover from, particularly for adults. This would have been the point for the Canaanites to get together and mass an attack against Israel. But they don't, because they're scared out of their minds. And yet here, right on the heels of an Israelite victory in Ai, here we have this coalition gathering to attack Israel. So what changed? Why do we think the Canaanites are now emboldened against Israel? What has happened that might have emboldened them? Especially those of you that have been here in the study for a while. What has happened recently? John?
It looks like they're kind of unified together. They build an ally group that makes them feel protected from God with this verse.
All right. Yeah, they think they're going to have protection in numbers by coalescing together, forming a single coalition. Let's think about this, though. They had that option earlier in the book, too. They chose not to take it because they were scared out of their minds. Why are they no longer scared out of their minds? Solomon, I thought I saw your hand. Did you have an idea?
Because AI defeated them.
Because AI defeated them. I want you to look at the way that the book of Joshua reports this. In Joshua chapter 9, verse 1. As soon as all of the kings who were beyond the Jordan in the hill country and in the lowland all along the coast of the great sea toward Lebanon, Hittites, Amorites, Canaanites, Perizzites, Hivites, Jebusites, heard of this. Back in chapter 5, the text is really specific with us. The Canaanites heard that Israel, that the Lord had dried the waters of the Jordan up and that Israel had crossed over. We're told specifically what they heard, what they were reacting to. Here, we're just told they heard of this. But what's this? And I think Solomon has put his finger on it. More than likely, what it is that they have heard, what they are reacting to, is this news that Israel, Israel might have defeated Ai ultimately, but Ai defeated Israel in the first round. Israel is not invincible. Right? It's almost as if from the perspective of the pagans, there's some kind of mystique around Israel. And that mystique has been broken. And now they're willing to go fight. The lesson of this is that Achan's sin, assuming that this is what they are reacting to, Achan's sin has had far-reaching consequences. Right? What does Achan think he's doing whenever he's looking at that little pile of treasure in Jericho? And he's just getting paid. Right? He is just, all he wants is that nice cloak from Shinar and a few shekels of silver and a couple of other things. It's not much. Who's going to miss it? What could possibly go wrong with it? Right, and what we discover in Joshua is, well, what possibly could go wrong? Israel's defeated at Ai, and now their enemies are emboldened. And now they're going to have to face this unified threat from the Canaanites. Right, any questions or comments about any of that before we continue in the chapter? Wayne?
It just seems to me. They may have heard about AI defeating Israel.
Yeah.
They haven't gotten the word yet. They have that Ai was told to be wiped out.
Or it could
change their minds a little bit, but I'm just saying they could have. But
could be selective listening.
Yeah, and that's exactly what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Is that they want to hear what they want to hear. They got a chance. So
yes.
They get all everybody together, they may have enough to do this.
Yes. It's one thing to keep our eyes on as we're going through this chapter is this is not going to be the only report that we hear in chapter 9. All right, this coalition of kings, they have heard something, and they're reacting by going to attack Israel. We're going to read of another group of people in chapter 9 who have also heard something, and they react in a very different way. So I want us to keep our finger on that as we go through the chapter, because we're going to see how one group hears one thing and another group hears something else and they react completely different ways. So, good comment. Any other questions or comments before we dig in?
It just reminds me of the psalmist and also Jesus, like, you know, when the Pharisees hear that Jesus is a sinner and he's saying these things, they come and they gather around him, like they group up
That's something that is brought out towards the end of the Gospels, particularly in Matthew and in Luke, that when Jesus is at trial before the Sanhedrin, all of these guys have heard and seen exactly what everybody else has heard and seen. They've heard the teachings, they've seen the miracles, and there's a lot of people that we read about in the Gospels that their reaction is a reaction of faith. They hear the teaching and they're changed by it. They see the miracles and they come to believe. The Pharisees, the Sadducees, the chief priests, the scribes, the ones who are responsible for sending Jesus to the cross, they hear and see the same things and react in a very different way. So there is a matter of the heart there that I think it's useful to keep that in mind as we are reading this chapter, that there is a matter of the heart going on here. So let's continue into chapter 9. Let's go to verse 3, and we'll read through verse 15. But when the inhabitants of Gibeon heard what Joshua had done to Jericho and to Ai, they, on their part, acted with cunning, and went and made ready provisions, and took worn-out sacks for their donkeys, and wineskins, worn-out and torn and mended, with worn-out patched sandals on their feet, and worn-out clothes. And all their provisions were dry and crumbling. And they went to Joshua in the camp at Gilgal, and said to him and to the men of Israel, "We have come from a distant country, so now make a covenant with us." But the men of Israel said to the Hivites, "Perhaps you live among us. How then can we make a covenant with you?" They said to Joshua, "We are your servants." And Joshua said to them, "Who are you? And where do you come from?" And they said to him, "From a very distant country your servants have come, because of the name of the Lord your God. We have heard a report of him, and all that he did in Egypt, and all that he did to the two kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan, to Sihon the king of Heshbon, and to Og, the king of Bashan, who lived in Ashtaroth. So our elders and all the inhabitants of our country said to us, 'Take provisions in your hand for the journey, and go to meet them, and say to them, "We are your servants. Come now, make a covenant with us. Here is our bread. It was still warm when we took it from our houses as our food for the journey on the day we set out to come to you. But now, behold, it is dry and crumbly. These wineskins were new when we filled them, and behold, they've burst. Garments and sandals of ours are worn out from the very long journey." So the men took some of their provisions, but did not ask counsel from the Lord. And Joshua made peace with them and made a covenant with them to let them live. The leaders of the congregation swore to them. All right, so we've read about this coalition of kings going to attack Israel. This chapter, by and large, is not about that threat. We're going off in a different direction first. This coalition of kings is mentioned to set up a contrast, right? They heard something, presumably about Israel's defeat at Ai, and they reacted by forming a coalition to attack Israel. But the inhabitants of Gibeon also heard something. And the text here is specific about what they hear. They hear what Joshua had done to Jericho and to Ai. They also tell us a little later on what more they have heard. Right, from a very distant country your servants have come because of the name of the Lord your God, for we have heard a report of him and all that he did in Egypt, and all that he did to the two kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan, to Sihon the king of Heshbon and to Og the king of Bashan who lived in Ashtaroth. Right, so Gibeon has heard, and they have heard some very specific things, and what is Gibeon's response? Right, because we're given two different responses to stack up next to each other here. Rena?
Well, Gibeon is, they're going to try and deceive.
Yes, they're going to lie. They're going to try to deceive Israel into forming a covenant with them. Let's set the background to this real quick so we can understand the stakes, what's going on. All right, so keep your finger there in Joshua 9. But turn to Deuteronomy chapter 7 real quick. And I want us to see what the law commands about this kind of circumstance. Deuteronomy chapter 7, verse 1. When the Lord your God brings you into the land that you are entering to take possession of it, and clears away many nations from before you, the Hittites, the Girgashites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, seven nations more numerous and mightier than you. And when the Lord your God gives them over to you, and you defeat them, then you must devote them to complete destruction. You shall make no covenant with them and show no mercy to them. You shall not, and we could continue on with that. There are further restrictions as to how they're supposed to relate to these nations. First off, we should notice that it's the exact same list of nations between these two chapters, except for the Girgashites. And to be honest with you, I'm not sure what has happened to the Girgashites in between Deuteronomy 7 and Joshua chapter 9. Joshua 9 mentions all of those nations except for the Girgashites. And who are the people of Gibeon? Are they included in that list? Joshua 9 tells us something about the identity of the people of Gibeon. Joshua 9, verse 7, but the men of Israel said to the Hivites. The men of Gibeon are Hivites. That's their nationality. So is Gibeon under this ban in Deuteronomy 7? Yeah, pretty clearly. God names them by name. Right, when you go into the land, God clears out the Hivites from in front of you. You must devote them to complete destruction. You shall make no covenant with them and shall show no mercy to them. Right, so according to our reading of the law here, what should Israel do to Gibeon? Destroy it. Yeah, completely destroy Gibeon, devote it to destruction. So, what is our estimation of how this episode plays out in Joshua chapter 9? What's our estimation of Gibeon's actions? How would we characterize what Gibeon is doing? Okay, they're lying. Yeah, they're deceiving Israel. Is there any other way that we would characterize what they're doing? Rena?
They're definitely scared.
They are scared. And what does their fear cause them to do beyond the deception? I mean, what's the ultimate goal of their deception? Trying to join with Israel. Form a covenant with Israel. And ultimately, does it work? Well, maybe we need to just keep our finger on that question as we keep reading. The very last thing that we read in that passage, in verse 15, Joshua made peace with them and made a covenant with them to let them live. And the leaders of the congregation swore to them. So at least up to this point, it's working. All right, what's our estimation of things on Israel's part? Did Israel act rightly or wrongly, and how do we identify that? Louise?
Israel didn't discuss it with the Lord.
They did not consult the Lord. All right, that is something that's brought out specifically in the text. They took some of these provisions to look at them and seemingly confirm the story, but did not ask counsel from the Lord. And because they didn't ask counsel from the Lord, Joshua made peace with them and made a covenant with them to let them live.
This might be the first example where Joshua actually didn't live on God's will fully.
Yeah, there's definitely, Joshua has a role to play in this shortcoming. Absolutely.
It was Joshua that made the covenant.
Yes, yeah, Joshua is calling the shots. So you find Joshua and the leaders of the people both engage in these negotiations. It ultimately falls on Joshua. Right? The buck stops here. All right. So, now, I want us to consider this question from the other direction. I just want us to make sure that we're exploring this thoroughly. Is there anything that we can say in Gibeon's favor from what we've read so far? Obviously, we've still got some chapter left to read. And we'll get into chapter 10 at some point, too. But based on what we've read so far, is there anything that we can say in Gibeon's favor?
Point?
Huh?
They're resourceful.
All right. Let's focus on that for just a second, because that is actually something that I planned on bringing out. Let's see. Yeah, the text tells us. All right, so I'm reading from the English Standard Version. And the ESV tells us in verse 4 that once they had heard what happened, they on their part acted with cunning and went and made ready provisions and, you know, went and performed their deception. They acted with cunning. The interesting thing about this word, the Hebrew word that is translated cunning here, is a relatively rare word in the Old Testament. It doesn't appear too often. It is used in the Law of Moses 3 or 4 times. Let's just see how it's used real quick. Go to Exodus chapter 21. Let's see. Yeah, and here the ESV is translating the same word the same way. In Exodus chapter 21, verse 14. But if a man willfully attacks another to kill him by cunning, you shall take him from my altar that he may die. All right, so obviously we read a commandment like this, and that word cunning doesn't look so great. Right? We're talking about premeditated murder here in this verse. Right? So somebody willfully attacks another person to kill him by cunning. He gets the death sentence. Yes.
It's also mentioned in Genesis 3 about how the serpent is cunning.
Not sure if that's the same word.
It isn't.
Okay. Yeah, it might be a different form of the same word. I would need to dig into that a little bit. I wouldn't be surprised. So yeah, you also have the serpent described as cunning. Now, I want us to consider how else it is used. Here's an interesting one for you. Go to Proverbs chapter 1. And we're going to hear Solomon describe the purpose of the Proverbs. Why do we have Proverbs? So we'll start in chapter 1, verse 1. The Proverbs of Solomon, son of David, king of Israel. to know wisdom and instruction, to understand words of insight, to receive instruction in wise dealing, in righteousness, justice, and equity, to give prudence to the simple. And there's our word, by the way, prudence, the ESV translates it here. It's been translated cunning in Joshua 9 and in Exodus 21. Here it is prudence, to give prudence to the simple, knowledge and discretion to the youth. It is used similarly in chapter 8, verse 5, and in chapter 8, verse 12. Exactly the same word used for prudence. So the basic idea behind this is forethought. All right? Solomon, through the Proverbs, wants to teach people to think ahead. Engage in some forethought. Be prudent. The law of Moses condemns people who kill other people with forethought. Now, that's premeditated murder. What Joshua is telling us here is that the men of Gibeon are acting with forethought. They're thinking ahead. Now, does that tell us yet whether it's good or bad? Not yet. Let's dig in a little bit more. All right, is there anything else that we could say about the men of Gibeon in their favor? Raina?
Well, they acknowledge that God has the power.
They do. And that is a big deal in this book. I want us to go to Gibeon's confession. Let's see. We'll go to chapter 9, verse 9. We're going to hear this repeated again, by the way, later in the chapter. Joshua chapter 9, verse 9. They said to him, "From a very distant country your servants have come because of the name of the Lord your God." Now, it's because of God's reputation. Now, before we continue on, who's the only other person in the book of Joshua who has expressed any kind of concern for the name of the Lord God? Joshua himself, when he prays in Joshua chapter 7. Ai defeats Israel, and Joshua tears his clothes, he's in mourning, and he offers up this heartfelt prayer, and his chief concern that he expresses at the end of that prayer is for the name of the God of Israel. And now for the second time, we have heard someone talk about the name, the reputation of the Lord, and it's these Gibeonites. We've heard of the name of the Lord your God. We've come because of the name of the Lord your God. For we have heard a report of him and all that he did in Egypt and all that he did to the two kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan, to Sihon, the king of Heshbon, and to Og, king of Bashan, who lived in Ashtaroth. Right, and so because of that, our elders told us, do all of this stuff, go and make a covenant of peace. Who's the other person that we have heard this confession from in the book of Joshua? We've heard the report of everything that your God did in Egypt, what he did to the two kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan, to Sihon and to Og. Who's the other person who has cited these events? Rahab. What do we think of Rahab, by the way? It's been several chapters since we have talked about Rahab, but I think let's finish up by talking about Rahab. Should Israel have formed a covenant with Rahab? Why?
Because she repented.
All right, because she kept the spies safe. Because she repented, because she sought to join Israel. Go ahead.
She made the gospel.
Yeah, I mean, it's basically an early presentation of the gospel that we hear out of her. Now, I want you to consider this. We started out in Deuteronomy 7, reading this prohibition under the law. And we said pretty much immediately, yeah, Gibeonites suck. kill him. That's what the law says. Why did we not say that about Rahab? She's covered under that prohibition too, you know. Did Israel make a mistake in making a covenant with Rahab? What do we think about Gibeon? We're going to dig into this some more. I mean, we're basically out of time. But we're going to dig into this some more. I want you to think on this for a little bit. In what ways does Gibeon differ from Rahab? That's one thing that we're going to look at in the text. We're also going to look at a few other things. We're going to look at what happens afterward, because the last half of the chapter deals with Israel discovering the deception. We're going to look at Israel's reaction, but then most importantly, we're going to look at the Lord's reaction. All right, so I want you to keep your finger on those things as well. If we're going to render judgment in one way on Rahab, are we going to render it in a different way on Gibeon? And is our judgment, well, how does our judgment stack up to the Lord's judgment in this? And I think once we are done reading, especially through chapter 10, we'll get some sense of what the Lord's judgment is in this circumstance.
You're basically saying that the Israelites should never even make covenant with Rahab, because she was came from one of those tribes. That's what you're trying to tell us.
So if we were to just take straight out of the law and say, this has to be followed in exactly this way, then maybe we would be inclined to say that Israel should not have shown mercy to Rahab. There are some commentators who think that, by the way. What does the New Testament think about Rahab? New Testament thinks she's great. and this is why, by the way, when we were studying Joshua chapter 2, I camped out on this point for a while. Might remember. The New Testament's estimation of Rahab is she's tops, because not only is she mentioned in the Faith Hall of Fame in Hebrews chapter 11, but where's the first place that we hear the name of Rahab in the New Testament? In the genealogy of our Lord. She gets to be part of the lineage of Jesus Christ. What does the Bible think about Rahab? The Bible thinks she's great. I mean, the Lord would have used somebody else.
Ultimately from that tribe.
Yeah.
But the reality is that it's a constant. You see throughout Scripture where Satan's trying to break off that lineage to make sure that we don't get to Jesus. I mean, you even look at but he actually helped to rebuild the foundation of the temple. And he was Jesus' cousin. I mean, this whole lineage.
Yeah.
I mean, as much as I hate reading the lineage part of
it, it gets important.
When I stand before Jesus, it's important.
Yeah.
To know that they were in the line of Jesus.
Yeah. And it's funny that you mentioned the rebuilding of Jerusalem after the Babylonian captivity. That's actually, we're going to come around to that as well in studying this issue of the Gibeonites. So what I'm going to leave you with today, because it is time for us to quit, is I want you to, I guess, reserve judgment for right now. And be thinking through the pros and the cons of this from a biblical perspective. I think we've gotten a good foundation in both areas this morning. The cons of it, what would condemn Israel and condemn Gibeon, those I think are both pretty clear and obvious. The law prohibits Israel from making this kind of covenant. Gibeon lies, which again, how's that different from Rahab? What does Rahab also do? Lies through her teeth. Not to Israel, to the men of Jericho. There is a difference there. But again, I want us to be open to where the book of Joshua is going to take us and where the Bible is going to take us on the people of Gibeon. And I think we'll find something interesting. Okay, thank you so much for your questions and comments and your kind attention this morning. It is our custom, if you're visiting with us, because of the pandemic precautions that we have in place, it is our custom during this in-between time to go outside.